Hey, welcome to Legal Marketing Radio from LaFleur. I'm your host, Stephen Kent, and twice a month, we're bringing you the tips, strategies, resources, and the news and trends from the legal marketing world that you need to effectively market your law firm. This week on the podcast, we'll be talking with LaFleur founder and president, Chip LaFleur, about the value and power of analytics in digital marketing, and also some of the new trends in predictive analytics that are shifting the landscape of the digital marketing world in a profound way. To learn more about how LaFleur can help your firm as a full-service legal marketing partner, just visit our website at LaFleur.marketing. That's LaFleur.marketing. Okay, no further ado. Let's get started with this week's episode of Legal Marketing Radio. Okay, so on the podcast this week, we have our regular contributor, Dave Vandewa, who is the content director here at LaFleur.
Hello. How's it going, Dave?
And a new guest on the podcast, we have LaFleur president and founder, Chip LaFleur.
Hey, Stephen.
Excited to have you here, Chip. And not only is Chip our fearless leader, as we like to say, but Chip is also kind of our resident tech, IT, and analytics guy. So we're going to get into some analytics-based stuff in the podcast this week, and we're really excited to have Chip here to talk about that. So the first topic we're going to talk about this week, I recently wrote a blog post that you can find on the LaFleur website. That's at LaFleur.marketing. And I gave kind of a basic guide for how a law firm can set up Google Analytics and start using analytics to, you know, judge the success of their content and what they can do to attract more users and more engaged users in the future. So to add to that discussion, we kind of want to talk to Chip now in particular. Chip, you know, when you're working with a law firm, let's say you sign on, you know, a new client and you start to begin gathering some analytics data for them. What are some of the first things you look at to see how they're doing right now and where you think you can take them in the future?
That's a good question. So when we first sign somebody on, you know, of course we want to look at their overall traffic, how much are they getting and where is it coming from? And we can usually see a pretty good breakdown just from an overview of their analytics account. We could see if they're how much organic traffic they're getting, what percentage is coming from organic search, what percentage is coming from any paid spend. Are they doing display remarketing? We can see that, get an idea. Are they getting referrals from social media or other things like that? And that's kind of just a cursory overview, just to kind of get an idea of traffic volume more than anything else. If we're working with a firm that's had some success online, then those numbers should be, you know, relatively high. We should see some activity there. But then we want to dive in a little bit deeper and see why they're getting the traffic that they're getting, and what's that traffic doing once it gets there. And so then we start to take a look at traffic source, volume, of course, and then compare that to bounce rate according to traffic source. If they're getting, you know, really high bounce rate, no matter where it's coming.
Can we just stop a second and define what bounce rate is? I also covered this in my blog post. You can read it there. But let's define these metrics as we go along. So what is the bounce rate?
Yeah, so the bounce rate is someone who goes onto a page and then doesn't navigate to another page and then leaves the website. And so that's indicative of someone who may be very engaged in that one particular piece of information that they're reading or the thing that got them onto the site, but they weren't more interested in the rest of the brand or the site. So, of course, when that number is very high, then, you know, we know that people aren't that interested in the rest of the site, or they're not, or there's no calls to go and start diving into data elsewhere on the site. You may have a site that has a great deal of blog content and may be really interesting, but if it's not highlighted and people don't have an option to go find it, then they're going to just leave the site because it's not right in front of them. So all those things start to give us an idea of what that looks like, and then I think we dive a little deeper. And we start to
look. I'm just curious, too, before we move on from bounce rate, like, what is a standard bounce rate? Because I know it kind of varies by industry, right? So, you know, different types of websites are going to have a different type of bounce rate. What do you usually look to see that you'd consider successful for a law firm's website, in particular content like blogs or anything like that?
I think there's kind of two answers to that question. One is a comparative answer of what was your bounce rate at a point in the past versus what's your bounce rate now. Is it moving the right direction? So if that bounce rate starts out at 90%, can we get that lower? And is it getting better or is it getting worse as we add content and change the structure of the site? We kind of want to be below a 70% bounce rate for blog content and for traffic that's getting there through organic search. That's usually not too hard of a range to hit. I think on our own site, we have a bounce rate for blog content from organic search that's in the 30s. You know, so people find that content, they engage, and then they click through the rest of the site.
You're talking about on our own, the Fleur.marketing website?
Yeah, on the Fleur.marketing, it's in the 30s. Other clients of ours are in the 50s, you know, but we really want to be in the 70s or below. There's certain types of advertising that are going to get very high. Display advertising usually has a pretty high bounce rate. Part of that's attributable to accidental clicks. Part of that is attributable to the purpose of a display campaign. Sometimes we're trying to only get them to a single page. So the context is really important, and it's certainly not like a black or white, you know, well, it's this, so therefore that. We want to see what's the purpose of the traffic that we're getting there. You know, if we're doing a display campaign around an ebook or something like that, it's okay to have a high bounce rate because they're getting everything they need from that one page. But if we're trying to do something like, you know, push our content out through social media, we want to see a low bounce rate there.
Okay, so what else do you look at besides that?
Of course, we take a look at how many pages they're taking a look at when they get to the site. And these are just kind of overview things, you know. How many pages are they looking at? How long are they on the site? And what does their browsing habit look like? We want to look at what the most popular sections of their website are and try to identify opportunities for growth, you know. And so if we see that they're getting minimal traffic or very little traffic to their blog, if they're getting very little traffic from organic search, then those are some things that we know that we can help with. And so when we can flag those things, you know, that helps us make a strategy around what we can best deliver. Same thing goes for practice areas. You know, if someone comes to visit the site and briefly spends some time on the practice area and then goes away, or, you know, all the traffic goes to the contact us page, those are some indicators that there's not much depth of content there and we need to expand on that. So it kind of gives us an initial roadmap. The first dive into it gives us an initial roadmap of what should we work on and where should we focus most of our energy.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that analytics kind of divide into what I understand to be kind of two broad categories too, right? There's sort of your quantitative analytics and then your engagement analytics. So I feel like a lot of attorneys who are looking at analytics for the first time are going to tend to gravitate toward page views, right? And raw traffic numbers like that. But that's not kind of the be-all, end-all, right? Can you explain why that is and how some other analytics might complicate those numbers?
Yeah, and I think that's something that, you know, when we at the very beginning of doing this and when we first started having access to this sort of data and this sort of analysis, you know, we were all kind of taken into, well, how can we just deliver the most traffic, period? And, you know, I know myself at the very beginning, you know, we had clients that we were working with and the goals were built around how can we get this number of total visitors up, you know, or total unique visitors up. And so in the end, that's easy. Because we can get display campaigns, we can do things like Outbrain, which is a media syndication platform, which certainly has a place, and there's a scenario where it makes sense to use it. But we can get inexpensive traffic through that. So, you know, very early on, of course, when that was the goal, we'd find these tools and we'd identify a new source of volumes of traffic, and we'd tap into that and feel like we were getting a great deal because we were doubling or tripling our traffic. You know, as time has gone on, of course, you know, analytics itself has gotten to be more and more in-depth in terms of what we can dig out of the platform. You know, myself and others in the industry have seen that, you know, we can go a lot deeper than that and find out and really start to gain kind of quality metrics around what that traffic is. And so then there's a big shift around, is it better to have minimal or a sustainable amount of really high quality traffic versus, you know, a huge volume of just traffic for traffic's sake? And I would lean towards saying, generally speaking, you're a lot better off having a manageable volume of high quality traffic that really wants to be on your site than you are just getting everybody to your site for half a second and then they leave. And so that's where I think we've ended up.
So when you talk about, you know, a lesser amount of more engaged traffic, how do you go about cultivating that a little bit more than, you know, let's say you're seeing those low and kind of engagement numbers. What do you think are the steps that really can create that more engaged audience for a law firm website?
Well, I think that's where, you know, the skill set that you and Dave Kyle, Jane, the rest of our writers really bring to the table, which is building an understanding of who that audience is and what they're interested in. And that's what I think, that's one of the many things that I think you guys do extremely well, which is get into the minds of the end user who potentially is going to hire the firm that we're working with to represent them. What are the things that they're looking for? What answers do they want to find? And how do they want those answers to be presented to them? And of course, they want them in a way that they can understand. And then if this is something that they're interested in, like if it's a personal injury, if it's a potential personal injury case, someone's interested in finding an attorney that can help them, like their first concern is not necessarily finding an attorney. It's, what are my options? What should I be doing next? Did I make any major mistakes? You know, and so that's what I think that when you guys work with our clients to come up with an editorial calendar, you do this deep dive into kind of the psyche of their potential clients. And when you understand that, then you write for that client. Now, that understanding is also built on experience, of course, you know, writing for other clients and really understanding the industry. But it's also built on a deeper dive into the analytics of multiple clients that we've already worked with. What are the articles that are successful? What are the ones that are less successful? What tends to be more engaging? And then that coupled with looking again for opportunities that are out there. What are some keywords that are maybe underserved that we can write about to drive that traffic in and then find that engagement?
Analytics can really show you if someone's content on their site is patchy. You'll see with a lot of our clients, what you see is you see a lot of traffic on the pages that we want traffic going to, because you want to funnel these people from interest in a blog post to interest in the firm's services to finally taking action and calling this firm. And so in analytics, you can see how content looks. Sometimes the content looks a little patchy, where you'll see traffic going to kind of arbitrary places throughout their site without any real direction. What you want to see is people moving in the right way. You want to see them coming in from blog posts, gaining awareness of the client, gaining awareness of their issue, learning more about what they need, and then moving to the service areas where they learn how the firm can help them. And it entices them to finally convert and sign on, which is what you want to see them doing at the end, is taking action and calling the firm or filling out a contact form.
So when you see the site having kind of this patchy appearance in terms of, you know, where people are going, would you characterize that mostly as a site structure issue where you kind of need to rethink the user's journey through your website if you're seeing that?
I think partially it's a site structure issue. It could be fixed in ways where you look carefully at how the content and how internal linking works, how the navigation looks. It might be the case that it's just impossible to navigate to certain pages. I see that once in a while on websites where you just cannot get to certain pages with the navigation, but they may be indexed some way. So they pop up in search, but you can't get there once you're on the site. And so you may have structure errors or internal linking errors, but a lot of the times it's a lack of a direct and focused approach to their strategy, where what you want to do is you want to funnel your traffic on your site. And if you're just blogging for the sake of blogging or tossing stuff on your site because it sounds interesting in a sort of ad hoc or arbitrary fashion, then that's going to show up in your analytics too, where the top 20 pages, the top 25 pages are sort of arbitrary. There's no real rhyme or reason to why they're doing well. There should be a good reason why the top pages that get the most views or that they get the most traction or are the most successful are in those top spots.
Just to touch on that site structure thing a little bit further, that's also one of the things that we look at when we first start working on a site. And I'm not talking about from the user experience side, but from the analytics side. If we take over a site and the site structure does not differentiate the individual blog posts from the rest of the pages on the site, then that presents a problem too. Because inevitably, I mean, a lot of the work that we're doing is tied to the blog and the content of the site. But if we can segment that out and say, hey, this is the amount of traffic that you're getting as a result of blog posts versus this is what you're getting on your practice pages versus this is what you're getting in your home or contact us, then we have a problem there too. And that's a different way that we look at the structure of the site itself. And so, you know, we get a lot of sites where it's just domain name.com/article name. And there we can't really differentiate and say, without doing a lot of work in the back end and flagging every single blog post and saying, hey, these are all the posts that make up your blog. Well, if you have hundreds of thousands of blog posts, that's a challenge. So if the site has the right directory structure in the first place, where it's domainname.com/blog and then /article title, or even /blog/category/article title, now we can start to get some really actionable information. And there's arguments to be made towards using the blog nomenclature versus not using the blog nomenclature. And there's also arguments for and against using the category splits. And we come down somewhere in the middle of that. Sometimes it does make sense to use that category split versus not. But in my opinion, it always makes sense to use something to differentiate the fact that, hey, you're on the blog content. You're on the side of the website that has recurring posts, educational articles, and things like that. Because if we don't have that structure to begin with, then we can't differentiate and point to success in one area and say, this is working, you know, we should work on this over here too.
There's nothing more frustrating in analytics than a really shoddy structure and URL structure. It's terrible.
Right, because it just makes it impossible to track, you know, what's coming from where and which sections are performing better.
Yeah, you almost have to do it separately. You have to compile the data and you have to, you know, double check each one and then compile it separately. And so you can still track that data. It's possible. It's just 100 times more time consuming.
Got it.
And the bigger the site, the more important it is too, where if you have somebody who has different post types or different blog type of content, if you can section those out and put those each in a section that's going to be reflected in analytics, you know, maybe you have a news section, you have a resources section, you have a video section. If you have each of those differentiated within analytics itself or within the site itself, that's going to be reflected in analytics. You can measure the success of each one of those areas by itself.
And on the user experience side, it's also a huge bonus because people can read and understand what you're doing in your URL. When people land on that page, they can go or they see the URL link. It's not, you know, your website plus a bunch of numbers and letters that don't make any sense. It's a very clear, oh, I'm in this section of the site, this is the category I'm looking at, and this is the post I'm reading, versus just a post all on its own, kind of on an island.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I want to talk about a little bit is, you know, from my experience, at least from a content standpoint, you know, when you're looking at analytics, one of the things that can be tough to figure out is, you know, when a given page is performing well, you know, what aspect of that page, even within the content, you know. Sometimes we look at the best performing articles on a website and we just go, what? Those? You know? And then you kind of have to look through and you know, can do some guesswork, but it can be really difficult to identify, you know, sometimes what about a piece of content makes it catch on. But I know that one of the things that you like to talk about and have an interest in that has some potential in this kind of area is machine learning and predictive analytics. Right? Now, I know you usually bring up those two things, but I feel like when you talk about them, they kind of come part and parcel together. Are they kind of two inseparable issues, or is that two separate things, machine learning and predictive analytics?
I think that they're two slightly separate but tied in together things. So we use machine learning to create predictive analytics. And, I mean, this is an emerging thing right now, and so unless you're a data scientist, then I don't think you can speak with too much authority on this. But there's some entities out there that are trying to bring this into the realm of a normal sized small, mid sized business. Microsoft is doing that. Google is certainly making an effort to do that. Amazon Web Services have some things to that effect. And so, we need machine learning to really plow through the vast amounts of data that we can use to actually make predictions about our analysis, right? Mm-hmm. And so the idea is you take a bigger data set than what a human being might be able to parse and go through, and then it goes through and it looks for patterns. And, you know, the data scientists that are going to be tied into that are going to be the ones who are choosing which algorithms make sense. You know, is it a ranking algorithm? Is it a this or that type algorithm, and I'm sure there's a more technical term than this or that, but, you know, sorting algorithms and things like that. the different tools that are available on the machine learning side can process this huge amount of data and then come up with more or less accurate predictions about that data.
This is something, they did a case study on the Titanic, right?
Yeah, so...
Let's talk about the Titanic case study a little bit.
Yeah, it's really fascinating.
So I went to my high school reunion, and I ran into a buddy of mine from high school and started talking to them about what we're doing. And his wife said, hey, you know, that's really interesting stuff. You know, are you using predictive analytics in that? And, of course, I thought, yeah, I'm making predictions about what the analytics say. And so I started talking to her and really kind of making a fool of myself because I think I know what I'm talking about, as you do. And she goes on to explain, you know, she works for Microsoft and she's kind of a brand ambassador around Microsoft Azure and predictive analytics. And she starts explaining to me kind of what this is, you know, and it's a high school reunion. And so I only have a chance to talk to her for a couple of minutes. Well, she sends me over some information to look up, and it's on Microsoft Azure's site. You can find it if you dig into it. We can post a link to it. But basically, it's an example of what you can do with predictive analytics. And the example space is taking all of the passengers in the Titanic and all the data that we have around those passengers and then trying to make a predictive model around which passengers would survive and which would not survive. So they take this huge data set, a few thousand people. They've got, you know, of course, their names. They've got their ticket numbers. They've got their cabin class. They've got how much they paid for the cabin. They've got their age. They've got their gender and a few other things. And so in this online demo, you know, she goes through and segments out and says, okay, this data point's important. This one I don't think it is. This one probably is. This one might be. Kind of highlights which one of those data points might make sense. And then separates out the data into, I think, 3/4 and 1/4. So she takes 75% of the data and feeds it into the machine, you know, into the computer. And the computer crunches those numbers and comes up with a model and says, here's what we think that we can do. And then you take that reserved portion of the data, that last quarter or so, and you feed that into the machine to then test its theory. And because there's enough data in that whole process, it has enough to say, here's our accuracy rate. And so at a first pass, I think it comes out with like 75% accuracy. You know, a future additional passes through and some tweaking to which algorithm is being chosen and things like that, the accuracy rating creeps up closer to 80%+. And so then you can take that and you can push that over to a web portal or to a back end, and you can say, okay, well, let's make up a person, you know, and you say, okay, well, what if this person had, you know, this type of ticket, they were this gender, they were this age, what would their survivability be? And it'll spit it back to you. And of course, in Microsoft's example, now they use Jack and Rose from the Titanic movie. And of course, you know, the sample spits out that Rose survived and Jack didn't.
That's amazing. So that's the predictive part, right? Once it's refined, kind of the algorithm and tested it, you start to have that predictive value where you can make, you know, educated guesses or even better about what's going to happen in the future.
Right. So it's an educated guess that has a percentage of accuracy rate that we can know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're starting to see a lot of articles, a lot of content come out about this. We're seeing less in the way of practical usage of it. But we have a lot of ideas coming that are rolling together that employ this.
Just to be clear, though, too, I mean, we already kind of interact with this stuff on an everyday basis, right? I mean, for instance, when Google, you know, tries to correct your search for you, that's a form of machine learning, right? So companies are already, applying this stuff in a variety of ways. It just kind of hasn't, you know, integrated into the legal marketing vertical yet, right?
Well, I think it probably, I mean, in some ways it certainly has integrated in the legal marketing world, in that you can set bids based on Google's prediction of whether or not that person's in the market for services. So, you know, on one hand, we're already using this technology, you know, the pay-per-click and on the digital advertising side. You've got a couple of big players out there that are bringing the technology to kind of mainstream. Adobe's one, Salesforce is another. And there are a ton of smaller players that are rolling out different versions of this. Some are mediocre, you know, some do a little better than others. You know, what we can have access to within Google itself is pretty impressive, and it's pretty cool. And, you know, we're only going to see that become more and more popular. But what we will start to see over time is taking these models and really separating them just from Google, where you can have this like standalone process that's analyzing traffic patterns and things like that to try to give you the ability to at least serve ads to exactly the right audience. You know, people who exhibit certain patterns who are more likely to, for example, need to hire a lawyer, you know, whether that's for, you know, personal injury, things like that. And we're seeing it in e-commerce, things like that, you know, where, well, you looked at this product, you might also be interested at this product. And that's probably one of the more practical ways that people are already starting to see it. That has to come from somewhere. And you could fake that by using tagging and some basic things. But you can really drive that home when you start to see people's buying habits and say, okay, well, they bought this and they bought this. We've got a cool project that we're working on that I don't want to give out details on right now. But, you know, it's taking this big data set and saying, hey, can we make a prediction about this? And can we get that prediction to be 70% or 80% accurate? And if so, then how does that impact, you know, a law firm? When we can make predictions like that, well, we can shift over high priority cases a little bit and just start to shape kind of what that traffic looks like. So there's a ton of opportunity there, and I think we're just at the beginning of it. It's a little scary.
It does have a little bit of a Terminator, Skynet vibe. I think the name that needs a little bit of rebranding, the machine learning, you know.
Right, right. For sure.
We'd call it like robot helping or something. So, I'm thinking of things too, like I'm sure it could be used for like lead scoring and things like that, right? You know, or for instance, circling back to the problem we're talking about, you know, rather than sorting through your own content and trying to find the pattern, which is kind of how, you know, today's algorithms start, or any kind of like evaluation of, you know, what is performing better starts. Instead, you kind of let the unbiased machine kind of suss out the pattern for you.
Right, right. And I mean, you take a look and you think through like A-B testing of different things. A-B test, you run it and the person has to look at it, make a decision which one's performing better. And you may have multiple data points that you're looking at to determine which one's performing better. Depending on what you're A-B testing, it may not be just somebody signing on or making a purchase, and maybe how much time are they spending on a site or things like that. So you apply some of these principles to even content marketing. You know, like the person who exhibits this pattern will be more interested in this piece of content. The person who exhibits this other is going to be more interested in this other. And, you know, websites now are deeper than just a site with this many pages, and those pages are static. We can dynamically change the content of a page based on the user going to the site. And so we could theoretically create models around a person who wants to really dive into content, you know, with a certain writing style or things like that. And we could modify the content that we're serving them. So we're going to start seeing those changes, I think, you know, in the smaller business world relatively quickly. I mean, it's going to change. And this could change a lot of things, right? Because then it's not that you just have to write one article. Maybe you have to write one article with a great reading level of, you know, college graduate, 12th grade, 8th grade, and then you serve up the one that makes the most sense.
Right, that's really interesting.
I just made it up.
But it's coming, so be ready for it. Okay, we got to wrap up for this week, but we want to thank Chip for coming on the podcast and Dave for being here again, as usual.
Sure. Thanks, man.
Thanks, guys. Thanks.
Appreciate it.
All right. That's it for this week's episode of Legal Marketing Radio. Check back in 2 weeks for another deep dive into the legal marketing world, including a discussion about how to boost on-page SEO and the value and occasional headaches of accelerated mobile pages, or AMPs. If you've got a question or topic you want featured on the podcast, just send an email to radio@lafleur.marketing. Thanks for tuning in to Legal Marketing Radio from LaFleur.